STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
The show is Stand to Reason, and I am Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel, who is usually here. You usually hear his voice this time every week, and so glad to be with you today. Greg is in the wonderful state of Wisconsin. Go Pack, go. Did I just say that? I was thinking it. I don't know if I said it, but yes, I've become a Packer fan since starting to do some of these chapels with the Green Bay Packers over the last couple of years. And that's where he is right now, enjoying his time in Wisconsin for his vacation. So I get a chance to sit in and help you, and hopefully give you a little bit to think about as some basic training for your mind, as Greg often says here. And we're going to do that today in a couple different ways. And the first way we're going to do it, and I've been looking forward to this since I learned we're going to get a chance to talk to Tim, is we're going to talk to Tim Challies, who, if you don't know who Tim is, and most of you listening to this radio, you're like, of course I know who Tim is, because Tim has really set the standard over the last, I mean, for as long as I can remember, in terms of thoughtful engagement of issues at his website, challies.com, where he has been a consistent, I mean, he sets the bar pretty high. And he just wrote a blog not a couple weeks ago, I think, called about being a plodding blogger, where we're just called to plod through and do our best to address these issues consistently. Well, he's written an article, a blog, that is really important. I want to introduce you to Tim. So let's get Tim on the line. Tim, are you on the line with me?
I am.
Hey, good to talk to you, brother. I had a chance. I was hoping to get to meet you personally at a conference in Toronto, because I know you're the pastor at Grace Fellowship Church there in Toronto,
yeah.
Correct? Well, let me just introduce you to those who don't know you. You're the author of something really cool for me personally as a designer, a visual theology, seeing and understanding the truth about God. I'd love to talk more about that as well, but and many other books. And as I said, you have set the standard for those of us who are blogging as Christians in this culture right now, because you've been doing it consistently and brilliantly for a long time. And I wanted to get you on the line and talk about this article you wrote called The Transgender Conversation You Need to Have with Your Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I kind of begin this conversation with you, let me just say that my observation has been that these issues of sexuality and of traditional natural marriage, of transgender issues, I think are the wedge issues of our time, and separating the influence the church wants to have from culture. So I was grateful to see you take a very balanced approach in your article. So before we get into the contents of that, just tell me, what was it that animated you to even take the step and write the article?
I think it was just thinking about the Obama mandate, or whatever it was, that was sent out to the public schools there in America. I'm of course, from Canada, but we've had similar things happen here. So just thinking about this transgender issue going public in that way across public schools, but then also an experience a friend described to me that I relayed at the very beginning of that article. That was the other thing that got me thinking.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that was really my wife and I, we read the article together, and that was just it's a great way to start the article, because it really brings the issue to the forefront and front and center. Describe that incident, that experience your friend had at an airport.
Sure, yeah. So we went and picked up my friend from the airport, and she had just flown in, obviously, and just by the by told us that as she was at her home airport, as she was going through security there, she tripped the alarm. The alarm went beep, 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 and so she needed the pat-down procedure. And if you travel very much, you're aware of the pat-down procedure. We all get it every now and again, where the officers have to frisk you. They have to pat down your body to make sure there's no weapons or anything else. And because she is a woman, she had the right to have a female officer do that pat-down. And so the call went out for a female officer. And the officer who came was an officer who identified as female but was clearly male. And so she had this frisk performed by somebody who is biologically male yet claiming to gender identify as female. And to me, that just kind of showed that that the transgender group has already won in the sense that they get all the rights. They get the rights to be who they want to be. We don't get the right of discomfort.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you identified what I think is the key problem here very early on in your article when you talked about how, and you say it this way, that in this way, sex and gender are being deliberately disconnected. So words like man and woman have no necessary correlation to male and female or masculine and feminine. Let's just talk about that for a second because that's what I see as well. I was teaching right. at Summit Worldview Conference, and a student in her high school years brought out a dictionary and said, well, here's the problem I see. And she read the definition of gender in the dictionary, describing a really identity based on social constructs, and saw that as very different than sex, man or woman. So there is now a disconnect between these two things. Talk about why that's where you see that headed and why that's a big issue right now.
Yeah, so what this whole conversation has done is it has taken gender and made it something very different from sex. And so it's done a couple of things. First, it's changed language, but it's also introduced new language. And you always realize that the person who sets the terms of the debate or the person who is able to frame the terminology for the debate always wins the debate. And so we're using words that were introduced by that group, words like gender identity, which we don't even really know is a thing. I mean, that's just a new word, a new phrase that's been recently created. I did a search for it not too long ago. You know how you can search Google historically, and it goes through all the books and looks for that term. And that term doesn't come into existence until the 1950s and 60s. And even then, really hasn't taken off until very recently. So there's a term that's being used like it's fundamental, foundational to humanity, and yet it's a brand new word. And so there's sex, which refers to our biology. There's gender, which refers to how we feel, or gender identity, which is how we feel. And then there's things like masculine and feminine, which is the way we choose to express how we feel. So there's all these different terms, and each one has a fairly defined meaning by one group. We may be using the same words, but in a very different way.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to this issue of restrooms, when you talked about this also in this article, when it comes to restrooms, the question becomes, how do we what are we using? If we were to say, okay, we are okay with you redefining these terms, even if we were to give these terms over and say, okay, we'll now make a distinction between what we used to think sex and gender meant the same thing, we'll say, okay, we get it now. Sex means your biological form, and gender really means how you subjectively identify yourself. If that was the case and we were willing to do that, then the question becomes, is bathroom selection based on sex or gender? You know, based on biology or based on your subjective identification?
Right.
So which is it? And that's where I think it's even more confusion, because we haven't really clearly identified the differences in these terms.
Right.
So right. Now we
and,
go ahead.
And to some degree, modern medicine has allowed people to change sex, or at least to change the external characteristics of their sex. And then gender has been made very fluid, so it can go back and forth. So you can see the idea here is to just take away all meaning attached to those things. So even gender-segregated or sex-segregated bathrooms or locker rooms, that can't be sustained under the terms of the argument. Eventually, we'll need to have entirely all single-use rooms or multi-purpose rooms for absolutely everybody. No other combination really makes sense under the terms of the engagement now.
Well, one of the things you tell me how you kind of feel about, respond to this reasoning I did with the student at Summit. I said, when trying to determine whether or not bathroom selection is an issue of biology, sex in this case, using those terms, or an issue of gender identity, it seems to me there's one attribute of bathrooms that kind of gives away which of these two we are deciding between, because women do not have urinals in the bathrooms, but men do. And the
right.
reason why we have different bathroom equipment in bathrooms is because we are built differently biologically.
Right.
So I think, really, to be fair, then, I could see a time coming when if we really wanted to break down the meanings between sex and gender, you won't see urinals, because urinals should be the one tip-off that bathroom selection is not a matter of what you think you are. It's a matter of what you physically are, because this is set up for you physically based on the presence of a urinal.
Right.
I mean, am I missing something here?
Yeah, I think so. One of the interesting things that's coming in on the back of the transgender conversation is people are attempting to develop urinals that can be used by either sex. And so there is some attempt to try and even blur that line. And, you know, it's interesting. If you go back in history, this phenomenon of mixed or of gender bifurcated bathrooms, you know, bathrooms for men, bathrooms for women, I think is a relatively new phenomenon because we used to only have single-use bathrooms, right?
Right, right.
And so we've done something recently, in recent times, where bathrooms have become gender segregated. So if all that happens is we go back to having all single-use bathrooms, that's not really much of a loss. I think we'd all be okay with that. Bigger concerns are if we have bathrooms multiple people are using and they cross gender and sex, or, of course, locker rooms and change rooms.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that's really the focus of – you have a very fair, balanced article on this where you just talk about our need to begin to have conversations with our own family based on the changing conditions of our culture.
Right.
And I thought it was just really brilliantly written and really, I think, available and accessible to any number of people because it's so fair. And it seems
sure.
to be very fairly written. So just let's talk about what you think are the kinds of conversations we're going to have now with our kids, for example, and what are the situations that are going to force these conversations, whether we're ready for them or not?
Okay, so the actually encountering transgendered people is going to be quite rare because there are not very many of them. I just was listening to Al Mohler's show this morning, and I think he said the current estimates are something like 0.3% of the population may identify their gender different than their sex. So it's a very small population. And then the percentage of that group that would be willing to go into a bathroom or locker room where their sex is different from everybody else's would be smaller still, right?
So makes sense.
It's not that likely that in day-to-day life you're going to encounter transgenderism in that kind of form. My concern, or my primary concern then, becomes this, that if you once we've decided that you can use the bathroom that best fits your identity or the locker room that best fits your internal identity, then anybody can say that that is their identity, or anybody can then go into that bathroom, whether or not they identify that way. And what we're finding is that people are not allowed to question someone else's identity. So if I see somebody who looks very, very masculine walking into a women's change room, it becomes bigotry for me to say, excuse me, do you identify as a man or a woman? That's considered wrong. And so how do we keep people out of bathrooms now, or out of locker rooms, out of change rooms, who simply do not belong there and who may be going in to take advantage of others? We've lost any ability to do that. And there's quite a lot of news stories now about that very situation.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I would suspect, given the small number of transgendered people who would even be willing to do this and go into a bathroom, that yeah. you probably have a much larger number of predators who would be willing to. Now, listen, you're talking to a police officer, okay? So here's what,
right.
as part of my culture, this is what we do. We prepare for the vast majority of people are not lawbreakers. They're just not.
Right.
It's a very small percentage that are willing to break the law. So what we constantly do is get involved with a small percentage of people that end up being our whole world. We see them over and over and over again. You start kind of like get a twisted perspective on what's really happening in a culture, because all you're dealing with is the very small minority who are willing to break laws. But you're absolutely right what you just said about whether or not we are going to be allowed to ask the question. Already in California, for example, my son, who's working in law enforcement as well, told me that, you know, if you've got what used to be considered the kind of dog that would help you, to help the blind or help anybody who needs an assistance dog, well, now anyone can say their dog is an assistance dog, and the police are not even allowed to ask or ask for verification that you have a need for an assistance dog. So we are not just true that it's not just a matter of, well, you look bad if you ask. We are being prohibited from asking these kinds of questions, and that means that what you described, and you did it really brilliantly in your article, you said there is something that, to my mind, is of greater and wider concern. It's the fact that the same laws that allow transgender people to craft their own identity allow expansive rights to anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is hits the nail right on the head, is that we do have – and so we always get accused of – what would you say to this, Tim? We always get accused as Christians of making a big deal about predators, let's say, for example – when in fact, come on, this is a very small number. You're just using that excuse to push back on something you don't want for other reasons. So how would you respond to that kind of an accusation?
Well, I don't know how we can respond except to say that as Christians, God has given us his view of the world. We get to open the Bible, and it's like the Bible is a pair of glasses we put on, and now we get to see the world as it is. And that's exactly what we do. So we look through the Bible, and now we see the depravity of humanity. We see how human beings are full of lust, full of idolatries, full of desires, evil desires, and they will use anything they can to get a hold of those desires. So, of course, people are going to take advantage of this. And it's interesting, Time magazine just a couple of weeks ago had an article telling about a community in New York City where there is a pool, and these girls go there after school to change to do their swim meet. And there's been a man in that change room. He does not appear at all feminine. He has a big beard. And the girls are intimidated to become nude, to take off their clothes in front of this man. And so they approach the pool. The pool said, we can do absolutely nothing. Our hands are tied. We don't know if he identifies as a woman or not. Neither are we allowed to ask. So you have all these girls, 20 girls, changing together in a single-use family change room. Well, this man gets the room to himself. Is he transgender, perhaps? Is he mentally disturbed? He could be. Is he confused? Did he go into the wrong bathroom? Is he a predator? You just don't know, and neither are you allowed to ask. And so the right that goes out to transgender people now also goes out to predators, that they can use that very same right to cover for themselves. That is really my area of concern. And so when I write an article saying the conversation you must have with your family, this is the conversation I think we need to have. You can discuss transgenderism, but again, that's going to be very, very rare. And I really think most people in society wouldn't be that bothered if somebody who was identifying and behaving and acting like your gender, even though he or she was not, if they were in your bathroom, for example, that wouldn't be that big of a deal. I mean, that would still be a cultural conversation, but because it's rare, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But this is the one that's of far more concern, is what will come along with it.
Yeah, so I think most of us, if we divide on this issue as a culture, whether or not we accept transgender, whatever our backgrounds are, if you're a Christian or a non-Christian, one thing all of us do, though, regardless of our worldview, is we typically teach our kids about predators. We typically will see there's good. It's a noble effort to teach your kids about predators. So this is the one kind of conversation we can typically agree on, because we don't see it as offensive. We see it as something that everyone ought to. Now, of course, the problem is, and what we see here, is that this law has now opened up a whole other area that we have to be concerned about when it comes to predators. And is that basically the gist of what you're saying here in your article?
Right, exactly. So it used to be you would teach your kids, if you go into the change room and there is a man in that change room, you scream and you run out as quickly as you can. Right? That was easy,
right.
And we all agreed. And then if that happened, a pool employee would go into that bathroom. They might call the police, and they would get that person out of that bathroom, out of that locker room. It was quite simple. And there were people who were predators within the bathroom, so there was an easy way of dealing with them. Today, though, if your daughter goes into that locker room and there is a naked man lying on a bench there, exposing himself, she cannot complain. The pool employees cannot go and confront him. You certainly cannot call the police. And again, there's an article out of Seattle or out of somewhere in Washington recently where that exact same thing happened. This was an individual who was deliberately seeing how far he could push the law, and I think probably looking for a lawsuit so he could sue for discrimination. But he was willfully lying naked in a girl's change room, exposing himself to the girls for that purpose. And yet there was absolutely nothing anyone could do to stop him. It was the fault of the girls for being uncomfortable around him, not his fault for exposing himself.
Yes, interesting. You see, we talked about it, and you're really describing it as a logical slippery slope. It's not that we're saying this is a causal slippery slope, that if we allow this, that this is going to therefore dictate other things will happen, other dominoes will fall. But what we're saying here is that if you're going to allow this kind of logical reasoning to dictate how we really basically handle this issue of transgenders in bathrooms, then you've got other logical problems. And I just want to stop for a second before I want to get to your last paragraph. I think it's important. But I want to ask you this. There's a reason why I think that we are not even able to ask the question of the person who is, if there is a predator, for example, and he walks into the bathroom and he poses as somebody who's transgender to achieve some, you know, vile act. Well, there was a reason why we couldn't imagine the scenario. What kinds of questions could we ask this person that would not be offensive to somebody who might really be transgendered. You can see why law enforcement has its hands tied. What could it ask? What kinds of questions could it ask, right?
Right. All you could ask is, how do you identify? But that's such a matter of personal preference now. It's an internal matter. And the idea is, society is so prejudiced that it's shameful for a person to have to speak out on that. A person shouldn't have to defend that. And so that person walking into the bathroom, we cannot ask him. He may identify that way. He may not. He may just be going there to get his jollies. We cannot tell. And so that becomes such an area of concern. What are we allowing? And then how can we, as people who want to protect our children, even we who have no desire to see people of the opposite sex before us, as a man, you might be concerned of someone saying that she was molested in there or something, or a woman, going into a change room where a man is. Obviously, there can be concerns for safety. There can be shame. There can be fear. And yet these new laws, they simply don't account for any of that. They don't allow the potential victims to speak out.
Well, the interesting thing about your article, too, is this. It's very clear that what you're offering here is a suggestion that we start having the conversations with our kids for what is inevitably going to be the consequence of this kind of lawmaking. Now, I want to take a quick break, and when we come back from the break, I want to ask you probably one of the most important, because we could take this position, and I could be as even-handed as you have been, Tim, in your article. But you know, as you said in your last paragraph, that even if you did that, inevitably somebody's going to say you're fear-mongering, or that you are a bigot. And I want to hear how you would respond to that, because I think it'll be helpful for our listeners to be able to kind of gauge and craft their own response to try to dispel that common claim that's made against all Christians when we say anything. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss that with you. Sound good?
Yep, that sounds great.
Thanks, Tim. And we'll take a break right now. Come back. If you've got questions for me, we might have a chance to sneak some in. I'll give you a number to call in case you do. It's 855-243-9975. But in the meantime, after this quick break, we'll get to that question by Tim Challey. Stay with us right here at Stand to Reason.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org. and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR E-News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's Mentoring Letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free, so download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Here I am again, Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in here for Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason. Greg is out on vacation, and I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation we're having with Tim Challey about some of the most important issues of our day. And so, Tim, I got you back on the line here. I wanted to do a couple of things. The article you've written at your amazing website, by the way, which I follow on my RSS reader every day, and I try to tweet out once in a while to my readers as well, the articles that make a huge impact on my day. You wrote an article called The Transgender Conversation You Need to Have with Your Family. And we've been talking in the last 20 minutes or so about the reason why we need to have the conversation. I just wanted, before we kind of wrap this up, I wanted to take some time to really get to specifically the kinds of questions that you think we need to address and the kinds of conversations we need to have. We've been talking about why we want to have these conversations, but we haven't been specific yet about, well, what are the kinds of questions that we need to be traversing with our own children? So let's just talk about that a little bit. What do you suggest are the kinds of categories and specific questions we need to be addressing?
Yeah, so some of the questions are just what will you do if kinds of questions. So you have a son who's in high school, and there's a transgendered student who is now going to be showering with them. What are you going to do? How are you going to teach your son to deal with a situation like that? What would you expect him to do? Or what if it's your daughter, and she's going into the locker room at the pool, and there is that naked man there? It happened in Olympia, Washington. What would you expect her to do? Is she to go running out? Is she to just ignore him, pretend he's not there? What if your daughter's going into a bathroom, and as she walks into that bathroom, there is a man, somebody clearly masculine male, walking in at the same time, walking into the women's bathroom? What would she do? So questions like that become, in this cultural context, they become real questions. What if it's your daughter who's about to be patted down by that female TSA officer at the airport, but that female officer is clearly biologically male? Those sorts of questions I think we have to think about, and we have to have some at least tentative answer in our mind as to how we will deal with them. Even you and I have to be thinking about, you know, what if we walk into a locker room and there's a naked person of the opposite sex there? These are things for us to be considering just so when the moment comes, and it seems likely that it will at some point, what are we going to do? How will we react?
Yeah, good point. Now, so this is, you've asked some really important questions, and I could just hear the other side saying, okay, so Tim, so if you're going to end up being this concerned about the potential of a predator, yeah, then your kids are going to end up reacting to every situation as though the person's a predator, even if they're not, because they want to fault to the side of their own personal safety. So aren't you really then just building up this bigoted kind of fear-mongering wall that just treats everyone as though they're a predator for the sake of safety? And so what you've accomplished then is you've kind of used the predator excuse to teach this kind of bigotry to your own kids. That, I could just hear that being said.
Sure.
So how do we respond to that kind of accusation?
Well, in order to respond to that accusation, we have to think about what transgenderism really is and what our beliefs are on it, what we think it is, and whether transgender individuals are to be granted the right of their preferred gender identity. And I don't know that I'm certainly not ready to grant them that. So if you're going to call me a bigot for saying that I think somebody who's biologically male should change in a room with other biological males, then so be it. But I think, as you suggested earlier in the show, I think we can leave it that simple, that the biological males ought to be with biological males. And so if my children see the opposite or begin to experience the opposite, I would want them to be comfortable. I think they have the right to be comfortable and confident in a situation. So I would want them to, as quickly as they could, to remove themselves from that situation. And again, we don't know if that person is transgender or if that person is a predator. We just don't know under the current terms. So that, again, is the big point here. This is something new. Nobody, no society has ever tried to take sex and gender and separate them and then to allow people to define themselves however they please. So our children are essentially going to be the ones that are being experimented on here. I want to make sure my kids don't fall into this very negative experience based on this giant social experiment.
Yeah, and one thing I think you said well in your article, too, is that the troubling part of this is not that there is a law that now breaks down the issues of sex and gender in such a way that anyone can decide what they are. It really is the issue that it, along with this law, along with that first decision, is the second decision, the second part of the law, which says you cannot even move toward verifying that this
right.
is truly the life of that person involved. And really, it's the second part of the law that's the problem, even more than the first part, would you say?
Exactly so. So I go to a gym every week, and if I went to the gym and there was a transgendered individual in my dressing room, and I could go to the front desk and say, hey, just wanted to bring that to your attention, and they could say, well, we've spoken to that person, she identifies as transgender. That's one conversation, right? And it would be, you could see how that one would unfold and then the kinds of decisions you'd have to make then based on wisdom and conscience. That's very different from me going to the front desk and them saying, well, you're a bigot. You have no right to ask that question. That person is free to do what they want, whatever he or she wants, and we can't even ask the question. That's a very different set of decisions that then have to be made.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that's so powerful about your article, because when people will say that the word is fear-mongering here. It's not really our response in wanting to have discussions with our kids, like, as I say, is based on the second step of any law of this nature. And right. that's the step that opens up to all of the predators. Now, you said in the last paragraph of your article, you said that, you know, really powerfully, that if someone accuses you of fear-mongery and of inevitably of bigotry, that you have something you want to say to them. You said, but hear me. And I want you to just kind of cover what your response was in that last paragraph. I thought that was very powerful in addressing that issue.
Yeah. Yeah, again, just that concern that we're going full speed into this new and untested territory. Nobody's been here before. Nobody has tried this before. The laws have changed very, very, very quickly. There's been no time for consolidation, very little time to test these things out. There's just been this massive sweeping change that cuts to the very heart of humanity. We are so fundamentally defined by male and female. In just a matter of months, we've completely eradicated that. And so we're going into new territory here. It's untested, and it's now involving our children. If it was me, that would be okay. You know, I'm willing to be experimented on in that sense. I'm not afraid. I can deal with that. And, you know, I know how to make decisions. I know how to get out of uncomfortable situations. But if it's my 10-year-old daughter who's being put into that situation at the local pool or at her school, then I'm very concerned about it. As a parent, I'm absolutely responsible to protect my daughter, to protect her from harm. Part of that is by being with her whenever I can. Part of that is teaching her how to respond, how to react when I can't be there. And if she's walking into a bathroom and there's a man in there and she doesn't know anything about that man, I've got to teach her how to respond.
Yeah, very, very good. Now, Tim, I'm going to just turn a weird kind of corner at the very end of this because I just it's my own personal interest because I know your work. I'm familiar with your work. And over the years, I'm familiar with something that's off topic now, okay? This is something completely different, but it's your visual theology. I just have to cover it before I leave you because I'm not sure I'll get a chance to talk to you on the air again. And I just want to encourage people. You have kind of been involved in this for – I wasn't sure why, Tim. Are you did you have a background in the graphic arts? What got you started wanting to make visual – some of the theological concepts of Scripture and make them available to us visually? What started all that?
I guess I just have a real love for visuals and for theology. I'm not very good at creating visuals, but I enjoy them. I appreciate them. And I was seeing a lot of infographics out there in the wider world and thought, I don't think anybody has really tried yet to make infographics that teach theological truth. So they teach a lot of mathematical truth. They teach other things. I just hadn't seen anyone really try theological ones. And so I set out to create what I call visual theology. I hired some designers. We got some ideas together, and we tried to present truth in visual ways. And so we did something like lay out the books of the Bible like the periodic table of elements. So you can look at that chart, and it just displays the Bible in different ways. You can look at it and see how the divisions are, what the dating is, and things of that nature. So what we want is you to be able to look at these things and understand truth from them. That's not to say words no longer have any meaning or any importance, not at all. We just want these images to supplement words and really to appeal to a visual generation.
Yeah, I just got to encourage anybody who has not seen Tim's work on this visual, these infographics, as you say, really, really powerful. Over the years, as you kind of released them, you know, one at a time, I have started to collect these myself, you know, and other people have as well. Right now, your book, Visual Theology, Seeing and Understanding the Truth About God, is just out about a couple of months, and it is number one bestseller in Christian systematic theology. I would just recommend it to anybody who is interested. And it's so, what's great about it is it transcends language and it transcends age groups. So I've used these with my students in high school age students and even younger, and it's just really powerful. And of course, I trust your work has always been really theologically sound, so it's just been a great combination of sound thinking and visual presentation. I just want to commend that book to anybody who is interested in making a case visually for what they believe as a Christian. Really, really good work, Tim. I think it's great.
Well, great. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show today. It was a really important issue. I think these are the new wedge issues that maybe in my generation, the wedge issues were maybe, you know, science and evolution and those kinds of challenges. Now the wedge issues all seem to be centered around sexuality. So I think it is important for us now to kind of step up and have responses, be ready to go. And this article you've written, which I encourage everyone to go see at chalice.com, the transgender conversation you need to have with your family has been an incredibly powerful first step in thinking about what it is we're going to say to our kids. So thanks so much, Tim, for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, we're going to be back in 2 minutes. We'll take a call. And so if you want to try to squeak in a call, 855-243-9975, please do that. We'll be back in 2 minutes here at Stand to Reason.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org. or calling 800-2-REASON.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our 2-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas. And we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
All right, friends, Jay Warner Wallace here with you at Stand to Reason. Really glad to continue our discussions about the most important and critical issues of life, as always discussed here at Stand to Reason. Ethics, values, religion, these are the things that we talk about here at Stand to Reason, and really proud to be a small part of standing in for Greg this week. We are now going to go to Paul in Orlando. How are you, Paul? Good to talk to you.
Hey, I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing really good. You got a good question, I think. I want to get to you before I even do any commentary or any other calls. And by the way, if you're listening, 855-243-9975 if you want to call in with a question. Sorry, Paul. Go ahead.
No problem. Well, first, I definitely appreciate the work that you're doing, and it's pretty cool that you end up being the person on the line instead of Greg. That's kind of cool. So I appreciate that, you know, you're doing all the cool stuff you're doing. So
well,
I
appreciate you saying that. I can tell you this is you and I both have come back to this well many times to drink from it, because I, like everybody else, came up and was just so happy to see that there was a thoughtful Christian out there who had entertained all of my own skeptical doubts and had worked through those. And that's who Greg has been for me over the years. So I'm just glad to sit in his chair. So what can I do for you today, sir?
I'm on my own apologetic mission, if you will. I'm not on like a mission trip or anything, but I want to, you know, learn the things that are important so that I can be able to articulate them to people. And one thing that I'm not very good at is talking about why you should get from the esoterical God that definitely created this kind of thing to a Christian God.
Yeah, good point. And I think there are steps we take in this, right? I remember when I was first training up young people to take these trips with Brett Kunkel to Berkeley. And Brett and I kind of designed the first Berkeley trip. I just needed a trip that I could bring my high school students on where I could teach them about the Christian worldview in contrast to atheism. And so I really wanted a trip that would put them in harm's way, more or less. And Brett did this brilliant job of assembling a trip that he continues to take, by the way. If you go to str.org and look at the Berkeley missions page, you'll see that he continues to take these trips. But I remember we used a book by a friend of ours, Frank Turek, who wrote a book called Out of Enough Faith to Be an Atheist with Norm Geisler. And what he does is he takes these steps, right, these 12 steps. You know, if there's no truth, there's no objective truth, and there's no objective truth about God. So the first step is about truth. Then if there's no God, then he covers God's existence. But at some point, this is the foundation upon which he eventually gets to the case for Christianity. So you're absolutely right. You can make a case for truth, and then build on that the case for God's existence, even the case for miracles, yet still only be at the doorstep of Christianity. You haven't passed through that door yet. And that's, I think, exactly what our kids need to know, is that the evidence we use to make a case for God's existence, it could be used by a number of groups that believe that God exists. But in the end, there is another step we must take. And that is, I think, with this first step, I actually kind of came to it backwards. My own journey was that I was walked into a Christian church. The first time I'd ever been in a Christian church, evangelical church, for anything other than a wedding or a funeral. And the pastor pitched Jesus as a smart guy from the first century. I mean, he was very modest. He knew he had atheists in that group, and that's how he pitched him. And I thought, well, I want to see what the smart guy Jesus had to say. And after examining it like a cold case detective, I became very comfortable with the reliability of the New Testament. So I came into it. I wasn't at the God question was not in my mind yet. The real question is, can I trust the Gospels? And then I said, you know, if I'm going to trust these Gospels, they're making a claim about this Jesus guy. I need to go back and say, is this a good inference that God actually exists? And so I took it backwards. I started with the Gospels and then worked backwards, because I had been, my whole life, had not only just been an atheist, but a very adamant, stubborn, thoughtful atheist. I had many reasons why I thought atheism satisfactorily explained the universe in which I lived. I had to really examine those in a detailed way. So long answer to your short question is that I think in order to move from theism to Christian theism is entirely dependent upon whether or not the Gospels are telling us the truth about the resurrection, the ministry, the miracles, the life, the death of Jesus of Nazareth. Because that is what is going to move you from theism to Christian theism. It's on the strength and the reliability of the Christian source material. And so okay. I think you're right. If I'm going to now, I'll just tell you this though, Paul. When someone asks me, "Well, why do you believe God exists?" I'm very careful. So do you have 2 hours? Do you have some time? Because if you think I can give you a 140 character Twitter answer to "Does God exist?", I'm probably going to disappoint you. You know what I mean? And if you ask me, well, why do you think the Christian God is the real God as described in the New Testament? Well, do you have 2 hours for that? Because I can't give you that answer on a blog post or it's a cumulative, deep, robust. It took me 6 to 8 months to go through all that evidence and my own personal search. And so, but again, it all came down to, are the Gospels reliable? So I think that's how you turn that corner. Let me ask you a question, Paul. Has that been something for you? Where do you stand on this? Are you a Christian who's trying to explain it to friends, or do you sometimes? And so when you have this conversation with your friends, Paul, what is it that they? What's the pushback you get that require? What kind of answers are they looking for?
Like, why should I believe what the Bible says about Jesus? Or it usually comes from some other direction. It's usually coming from abortion or homosexuality or something like that. Usually coming from that direction. But the question is, well, why should I believe what the Bible says? I kind of believe in a God, but I don't know if I believe in this Christian version of truth kind of thing. Know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. I always tell people, and I made this statement in a movie called God's Not Dead 2, and some people push back on it, but I always say something akin to, I'm not a Christian because it works for me. Or I'm not a Christian because I was raised that way, and I'm not a Christian because I was hoping to change my life, and I'm not a Christian because I was afraid of hell or hoping for heaven. I just got to a place where I evidentially felt like there wasn't an alternative. But I can tell you of the time in my life, I always say this, my wife and I were together for about 18 years before either one of us became a Christian, and we've now been together for about 18 years since becoming a Christian. And if you asked us which of those 18 years is easier or was easier, we would say the first, because it's so much easier to throw that dart at the wall and then just paint the bullseye around wherever the dart lands than it is to have a bullseye on the wall to start with and try to hit it. And so when you say to me that your friends typically come at it from the perspective of abortion or homosexuality or those kinds of issues, what I'm hearing is that, yes, we all have these sets of behaviors we want to engage in. And then we want to be able to justify our behaviors to others. And so we know it, you really can't justify some of these behaviors from a Christian perspective. So therefore, we would never consider Christianity as a worldview even worth examining, but not because there's not any evidence for that worldview, and not because that worldview makes no sense logically, or not because it doesn't explain the world the way it really is, but instead because we don't think we can reconcile our behaviors, our desires, our wants with that worldview, so therefore we're just not going to go there. And
right.
So that's a tougher conversation to have, isn't it? Because it's really not about, the question isn't, well, is there enough evidence for this to believe it's true? The question is really born out of a desire for it not to be true because it allows me to live a certain way unchallenged. And that is where I stood for a number of years. And it really took me to be honest with me about what was keeping me out. In other words, is it really because there isn't enough evidence for this? Or is it, Jim, that you just don't want there to be enough evidence for this? And in the end, I think for a lot of years, I stood in that second position, where I just didn't want there to be enough evidence for it. So anyway, I hope that kind of helps you think through and walk through those issues, Paul, as you think
about
it.
Any books that you might recommend or resources you'd point me to?
Yeah, I think that
specifically for that question.
For that question. Like, well, yeah, I mean, if it's an issue where you think you've got somebody who is just in need of the evidence and that's what's keeping them out, well, then there's a number of good books that'll help you do that, right? Either books about the evidence for Christianity specifically. I know that I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Frank Turek and Norm Geisler kind of starts with truth, goes into God's existence, goes into miracles, and then finally goes into the New Testament. So that's a good kind of step-by-step. And all of Lee's books, Lee Strobel's books on the case for the Creator, the case that's all about theism, the case for Christianity, the case for Christ. These are books that kind of take the same kind of a step-by-step approach. My books are Cold Cases about Cold Case Christianity is about Christianity. God's Crime Scene is about theism. But really what you're talking about is what is it that holds us out when it's not the evidence? And that's a good question. I'll have to ask Melinda during the break if she can think of something. If she can, I'll talk about it after the break. But I have one chapter on this in Cold Case Christianity where I talk about there are three reasons why anyone rejects a truth claim. They are all shuns, why you would shun a truth claim. The first one is rational. I'm just kind of twisting the words a little bit here. But it's rational because it's evidence. But that's not where most of us stand. We'll say it that way. We'll say, yeah, I've got an evidential reason I don't want to believe this. There's no good reason to believe it or there's not enough evidence for it. But it's usually one of the two other shuns that's the tail wagging the dog. It's an emotional rejection. They've had some bad experience with Christianity or with Christians. Or it's more likely a volitional objection where it's about not wanting to have to surrender their desires,
yeah.
Surrender their life. And I think when that happens, this is it's time for us to stop giving evidence as though they have rational objections and to start to change the conversation. And tactics that Greg has written about this kind of helps you give a strategy for having these conversations. But this really about changing the conversation toward desires and away from evidence, really, at that point, I think. So I hope that helps a little bit.
It does. Thank you very much. God bless you for everything.
Thanks,
you're doing.
Paul.
I
appreciate you. Thanks so much. Now, before I check out for this hour, we've got a few seconds left. I just want to talk just briefly about an article I wrote this week and from some earlier work. And actually, I was prompted to write this because I was listening to Greg on a podcast several years ago, and it kind of got me thinking about the evidence and the claims that Bart Ehrman makes in his books like Misquoting Jesus, where he typically will offer 10 verses. At least he did this in the paperback edition on the final page of Misquoting Jesus. He listed the top 10 verses that were not originally in the New Testament. And what he's trying to argue here is that these are late additions and variants that were introduced by copyists, by either those who were copying or transmitting the Bible, and they should not be in your Bible, and therefore you shouldn't trust anything in your Bible because these verses you thought were so important were in fact added late anyway. And he's got a list of 10. I won't go through all of them with you, but some of them, just to give you an example, are things like, for example, the passage in Luke 22 where it says, "In his anguish, Jesus began to pray more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground." He would argue that this is a late addition. It doesn't appear in the earliest manuscripts of Luke, and therefore it is not part of Scripture. And he would argue, if you've got things in there today that shouldn't be in there, how do you know how much more shouldn't be in there? And this, in his eyes, discredits all of Scripture. Well, I'll make a couple of quick points about that, because I think that as somebody who looked at it from a detective's perspective, remember, every crime scene I encounter has two kinds of things in the crime scene. Artifacts, which just means junk that is not related to my case, that is there for any number of reasons, and evidence, the stuff that is related to my case that I have to sort through to make a case. Artifacts are sometimes when a paramedic comes in and tries to rescue the guy and leaves a bunch of trash in your crime scene. These are not going to help you catch the killer. They're artifacts in your crime scene. We are trained to remove the artifacts so all that is left is the evidence from which we can make a case. While textual critics do the same thing, and Bart knows this, when they remove artifacts from the crime scene of the New Testament, so we get back to the original set of evidences that tell us something about Jesus. And so when he does this and he identifies variants between copies of the oldest known copies of the New Testament, he's going halfway. He's identifying where there are variations. But he also knows that if we've got enough copies, we can return reliably to the original based on the majority text or an early text, and we make those kinds of calls as we go. And so we're able to remove the artifact, and that's why your scripture has got a footnote. Every time there's alleged variation from between copies, it's footnoted in the ESV. So let me make four quick points here in 5 minutes that'll help you to kind of parse through these objections from Bart Ehrman. The first is this. The verses that Bart points out in his top 10 verses, these are verses, and I use the two letters D and E to help you remember. These verses have been designated earlier, D-E, designated earlier, because seven of those passages that he actually calls out, they're not hidden passages. Those are passages that we've known about for hundreds and hundreds of years. They have been footnoted in your Bible for all this time. They are not something that has been discovered by Bart and now placed in his book. These are well known by even those folks like Bart's mentor, Bruce Metzger, was familiar with these passages. It did not impact his trust of the Bible. And he knew about those same ones. They've been designated for years. That's number one. Number two, many of the verses that Bart describes as things you shouldn't trust are described elsewhere, D-E, described elsewhere, and they are reliable in the other places they're described. In other words, if there's a verse that is a late addition, let's say, in Luke's gospel, but in the parallel account in Matthew's gospel, that event is also recorded, and that verse is not contested over there, then you can reinsert it into Luke. You can trust that Luke was telling us something true, because it exists somewhere else. It's described elsewhere. So this is how we return reliably to an original, is by comparing manuscripts. So number one, they're designated earlier. Number two, they are described elsewhere. Third, they are decidedly extraneous, D-E, decidedly extraneous. In other words, some of these verses, by reading Bart's book, you would think that if I lose this verse, I lose an entire theological concept. No, these verses have always been extraneous. In other words, one of the verses is 1 John 5:7, where he says that the doctrine of Trinity is described so explicitly, but that verse appears to be late. Well, I don't need that verse for my doctrine of the triune God. I make a statement about the triune nature of God. I investigate that and make my case for the triune nature of God from a number of passages. And if you type in Trinity at coldcasechristianity.com, you'll see how I've done that. I don't need 1 John 5:7 to make a case for the Trinity. I make a case for the Trinity on a number of cumulative circumstantial verses that point to the same reasonable inference. So I don't need it. This is decidedly extraneous. You can toss it out. You don't lose the doctrine of the Trinity. Last thing, the verses are detected easily. So number one, they're designated earlier. Two, they are described elsewhere. Three, they are decidedly extraneous. And four, they are detected easily. And what I mean by that is Bart is able to decide which verses are under a contest because he's using the same process that we use to get back to the original. In other words, he goes halfway. He says, I see a variation, but he doesn't use the system that's in place to resolve the issue. But we do this as textual critics, and Bart knows that. He just goes halfway to kind of raise the red flag without solving the problem, which is easily solvable when we look at all the majority texts or all the earliest texts to go back and decide which word ought to be there. And let me tell you how honest your Bible is. Your Bible is so honest that when you look at the footnote, you will see not only what word the translators have decided to put in, but they'll show you what the variant words were they looked at before they decided on that word. So if you had a question about what really that other options were, you can look in the footnotes and put the optional words in place. And guess what you'll discover? Not a single characteristic of Jesus is going to be undermined by any of these variants. You could remove every verse entirely in where you see a variant, and guess what you're going to be stuck with? The same Jesus that you know and love today, because none of these verses impact his divinity. He will always be, like it or not, born of a virgin. He will always have worked miracles. He will always have preached the truth. He will always have died on a cross. He will always have been risen from the grave. He will always ascend into heaven and always be seated at the right hand of the Father. You're going to be stuck with the same Jesus you know today, even if you took liberty to remove half of the verses, and even Bart would not suggest that half of the verses of the New Testament should be eliminated. But if you did that, you're still stuck with the Jesus you know today. So in the end, I wonder why we're even discussing some of the objections that are made by Bart, especially when they aren't going to change the nature of the Jesus he is so offended by. So hope that helps you to think clearly through what Bart is suggesting in his book. And I've got a great guest coming up in the next hour, so I want you to be ready for that interview and stay with us, because we're going to spend the next hour talking to one of the funniest guys I know, working as one of the smartest guys I know. I think you have to be smart to be funny. But anyway, I'm going to introduce him to you right after the break, right here at Stand to Reason. Oh, actually, we have another call coming in right now? Okay, got it. So before I go to this, let me say one thing. We're going to introduce you to Andy Bannister. And Andy is a guy who has been working as an apologist for a number of years. And if you know anything about apologetics, you know there's kind of like this, if I said to you, who is the one apologist that you think, wow, this guy, you know, he's just so amazing. Well, most of us would say, well, Greg Kochel. No, I'm sure he would. But you might also say Ravi Zacharias. And here Andy has been working with RZIM, Ravi Zacharias Ministries, for a number of years. And as I listen to his presentations, I've never met him personally, I find him to be one of the most cutting, insightful, funny apologists that are doing work anywhere in the world today. And he's written a book called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, a very provocative title. And what's great about it is most of you who listen to this show who have kind of some you've encountered skeptics either online, on social media, and you've kind of engaged in dialogue with these skeptics, you find yourself coming up against the same kinds of claims that seem rhetorically powerful. Andy approaches every one of those seemingly rhetorically powerful claims of atheists and finds a way to show you a great way to respond. And so I want you to stick with me for the next hour as we talk to Andy Bannister about The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. And we'll do that together right here at Stand to Reason.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.